Accession number 27185, reel 61.
Major Barras, reel 61. You're saying the exercises were mainly in the mountainous?
Well, yes, they were in the mountainous. Because that's you couldn't trample around the paddy fields and the lowlands, so we spent most of our time on the bare hills. We did a lot of it in the heat of the summer, which was quite trying, actually. I remember we had one guy who had heat stroke, and although he was sent back and packed in ice, he died. But I suppose it was training which we had to do, because if the Chinese decided to attack in the middle of summer, we had to be prepared to fight in the middle of summer.
Were your exercises primarily based on defensive operations, or were you?
No, we did. No, we did. We did attacks as well. I mean, it was the question of keeping the regiments and battalions, brigades, and so forth up to their normal training, whatever they would have to do. So you had to continue to learn attacking, withdrawals, defence, usual phases of war. Otherwise, you'd just get rusty. So we had to do a lot.
Did you have opposed exercises?
What do you mean with enemy?
With enemy.
Oh yes, there was always enemy there. Yeah, somebody had to be enemy. There were a lot of them. These exercises, but most of them were in the hills. That's what I remember. And of course, the thing here was that I had to get used to being supplied by mules. Now, what I didn't say was that after I'd been there about 2 or 3 months, I think, Paul Clemente Smith sent for me and said he wanted me to be adjutant, which I didn't face with much enjoyment. Having done it once, I come back to the regiment to be with soldiers and enjoy a company. But I couldn't refuse him. I mean, you can't sort of say, no, I don't want to. It's not the sort of thing you can do. Especially if you... I mean, an adjutant's job is a very influential job, and it's good experience. Even though you may think by doing it once you've had all the experience you need, that's not true. I found myself as adjutant after a period of... couldn't have been more than... 2 months, 3 months after I got there. So there I was. I was stuck in the house with behind a desk.
What? How did he use you as adjutant?
Well, Paul was... I hadn't seen him since before the war, and I don't know what he did between. He was a fairly small stature, chubby. He had a black moustache, black... rimmed glasses, I remember. He had a puckish sense of humour, quiet, laid back. He could be firm if he wanted to be. I got the impression at some stage that he really had no ambition to go any further than command, having got command. And I think he thought by making me adjutant, because I had had experience, whether I'd used it wisely or not was another point. But I'd been an adjutant, I'd been staff trained, I was substantive major, and I think if he thought by putting me in there, he could lay back even further than he'd been doing before, which he proceeded to. He was very supportive and he was very helpful, but he did leave a lot of things to me. I suppose if I'd done something wrong, he'd probably step in. I didn't really enjoy it so much as I had the first time doing it. When you do a job a second time, it loses its sort of...
loses its novelty.
Novelty, yes. But of course it was different circumstances, different people. I threw myself into the job and did the best I could with it. He was kind enough to recommend me for command when I'd finished. Must have done a fair job anyway.
What were the main range of duties? Were they the same as on the previous occasion? Or
well, very much the same, yeah. I was doing... we had orderly office once a day when the criminals came up from companies.
Were there many criminals?
No, not very many.
What sort of crimes had they committed?
Can't remember now. There wasn't much point in going absent there.
Where to go?
Where to go? I don't think there was very much in the way of... I mean, it was usually sort of things like being improperly dressed or being idle on something or other, prayed, not turning up for a certain thing, missing parade, or not missing a parade, but missing an appointment. Or of course, if missing kit and that sort of thing. If he'd lost his kit or wrecked his kit or something, then he'd be up before the CO for that, because the company commander wouldn't have the power to take his money. There was confined. Most of them were CB and confined to barracks, in which case they'd have to parade, yes, report to the guard room every so often, and then do a pack drill parade at a certain time in the evening. Mm. And that was it, really. There was a certain amount of illness there. Was tropical diseases.
I was going to ask you about that.
Well, encephalitis.
Yes.
Attacked a number of people there, which was quite frightening actually, because it was catching. It was contagious and it could move around. Luckily, it was contained, I think, but it wasn't a very pleasant thing to have.
Presumably, you'd had to have inoculations before you went out to.
Oh yes, yes, yeah.
You mentioned that there were snakes and scorpions in the garden, and that the weather could be very trying in the mountains, and death from heat stroke.
Yeah.
And you said you mentioned encephalitis. Were there any other hazards to health that were particularly striking?
I don't remember. There was heat exhaustion as opposed to heat stroke. Mm. People did get exhausted if they were caught in time, then there was no problem. There was always a possibility of dehydration, and people were encouraged to drink water as much as possible. And salt, take salt. But I can't remember anything. Of course, people were young and didn't suffer from the older complaints that we all get. we were all young then, so as long as they were kept fit, that was the main thing, was to get them out. There were games, there were swimming, it was competitions, there was a swimming pool there which was used, which we could get them and having intercompany swimming competitions and things like that. When the weather was cooler, got cooler again, there was football. I don't know whether there's any cricket, I can't remember that. Boxing, of course, that was another thing which was encouraged. Of course, we wore jungle green uniform with a beret. The men wear blueberry, and officers wore peaked caps. Except when we went on exercises, and we wore these dreadful floppy jungle hats. As I said, Anne was expecting, and I think around somewhere in the middle of August, early August actually, she said, I think it's going to happen. And before they got there, I managed to get a car, second-hand old banger, Hillman Minx. So I was in a predicament actually, because I had to drive her into Kowloon. The BMH on Hong Kong was being refurbished. We seem to do nothing else but live in places where the BMH is out of use. So she had to go to the general hospital in Kowloon. Well, we'd already employed a civilian gynecologist to look after her, because we weren't sure what was going to happen. So he was very good. She used to go and visit him and have checkups. And then when she said the day had come, of course, I had to drive her into Kowloon. Now, the road between Sakong and Kowloon had been quite recently built by the Royal Engineers, a concrete road, which wound its way around bends all over the hills, and was called Twisk. It was known as Twisk. So I got her in the car, and I thought, if I drive fast, I might bring it on. If I drive slowly, I might not get there in time. And in either case, I could find myself as an involuntary midwife. Luckily.
Holding the baby.
Yes, I was absolutely terrified. Mm. Literally holding the baby, yes. However, I managed to get her into the hospital in time. Well, we got her there, and it was a false alarm. Nothing happened. So for 48 hours, she went off, and the Tim Fairhurst is the name of the wing commander, Tim Fairhurst, who very kindly took her in. And she was there for 2 days until they started to come on again. So we rushed her into hospital. She was put in the delivery room and left. Now, this is in the Kowloon General Hospital, which was entirely different to what a BMH would have been.
Yes.
And I think she was just about to produce. And she called out, and a sort of Chinese nurse came in, looked at her, and was absolutely horrified and tried to stop it all. And then she left in panic, really, not knowing what to do. And luckily at that time, a British sister was walking past the door, and Anne called out, and she came in and did the delivery. Now, the gynecologist who should have been there was out playing golf somewhere. Well, I mean, this probably wasn't his fault, because he couldn't have been on tap all the time.
Presuming he could have arranged for cover.
Well, he might have arranged for something, but nothing was done, and it was rather harrowing for her. So that was Timothy's entrance to the world. And after that, I think she stayed in there for a couple, 2 or 3 days, because they didn't have the same facilities they do these days, or the same attitude, where they have them out and have them packed drill in 24 hours.
That's right, they do.
Yeah. But she stayed in there for a few days, I think, and then came home. Well, by this time, of course, we had to then employ nannies. We'd already got an eye on trying to get a nanny in Chinese. I don't know. They had another name there. Aya was the Indian one. I can't remember anyway.
Yes.
But we had one or two before we found the right one. I mean, Anne caught one hitting Christopher on the head, so she got the order of the boot pretty promptly. Mm-hmm. But Ayuk, one called Ayuk, appeared on the scene, was an absolute treasure. I think she was a Christian, spoke a little pidgin English, and fond of children, very loyal, very helpful, sensible, and as far as one could understand Chinese, a sense of humour. But of course they always laughed at different things to us. I mean, I used to laugh at anybody who died, actually. Laugh at things we'd never dream of laughing at, but that was the way they did it. I mean, it wasn't because it was funny, it was because it was the polite thing to do. So she came, and she was excellent. In fact, when we left, finally, a year later, she wanted to come home with us, but we thought about it and thought how nice it would be to have a Chinese looking after us at home, but we felt it wasn't fair on her, because after the children had grown up, what was going to happen to her? She wouldn't have any friends there, nowhere to go. And then we couldn't send her back to Hong Kong, because she wouldn't have anybody there to go to either. So we, without hurting her feelings, we had to turn down our kind offer when it came to the crunch.
Did you have other servants at home?
Yes, we had another cook and general sort of bottle washer.
How did you recruit them? Were there agents?
I don't know how we got them, actually. I think we must have got them through some sort of agent. We might have got them through what was called the contractor. Now, this was an old Indian thing that used to happen in the Raj, a contractor, was as honest as you can get them. Chap who spoke good English, had good contacts, and he would then, you'd have a contract with him to do certain things, like take away the swill in the kitchen, the back of the kitchen, which he would pay for, and then he would go and sell it at a profit to a farmer who would give it to his pigs. He would supply all kinds of things, a barber, for instance, if you wanted one. He'd come and bring in people to do jobs, carpenters or anything that needed in buildings, all that sort of thing. He would also have charwallas go out when troops are on exercise, and you'd have this charwalla following the troops out with an aide behind him carrying a great big urn, and they would sit quietly under the trees waiting for an interval in the exercises or whatever we were doing. Then they would then come and go around putting tea into the troops' mess tins, which they produced, and charge them a couple of rupees or whatever it was. And this was allowed and was quite legal and encouraged. It didn't replace the proper food and meals that the troops had, but it was a good morale raiser between gaps in the exercises, and it saved us sending somebody out. And they made a bit of money on the side. They also made suits. As I said, they did haircut. He made a nice little tropical suit, cotton grey suit for me when I first went out there. Cost hardly anything and perfect fit.
Sounds as though your contractor was a sort of general man of business.
Yes, he was. He was in it for business, yes. Mm. But he was recommended by the previous battalion who'd been there. They'd have to report on him, and they give hand over a report from one CO to the next, and then they'd decide whether to give him the contract and keep him on. I think some of the things that were written in those reports shouldn't have been shown to the contractor, because I think there was, although they probably gave him a good report, there were some amusing bits. I remember seeing one with some amusing little bits in it. But no, they were very useful. They were usually Indians. They weren't Chinese at all. They were usually Indians or what became learned later as Pakistan. Mm. Pakistanis. And at Christmas, they used to come round. The chap himself, the contractor himself, used to appear. And anybody he thought had an influence on continuing his contract, he'd come with a whole lot of gifts and lay them out on the sort of patio at your bungalow. And you obviously couldn't accept. It was not done thing to accept expensive gifts of that sort. But for good relationships, you could probably choose something which wasn't too expensive. And I remember him coming, and he laid all these things out on the patio there. Dinner sets, suits, silk things, and all kinds of things you can imagine. And there was a Christmas cake as well. And without thinking twice, both Anne and myself looked at this Christmas cake and said, "We'll have that." And I think he expected us to have it, because it was obviously the cheapest thing that was there. But it was an excellent cake. I always remember that cake. It was the nicest Christmas cake we ever had, I think. It was quite large. It lasted us a long time.
Did the regiment have formal social occasions, like band nights and things like that?
Yes, I had to attend as a married officer. I had to go in once a month to guest night and attend a dinner. But they weren't all guest nights. They were sort of dinner nights.
Where was the mess? Was that at Fan Ling?
Yes, yeah, it was all out there, everything. I don't know whether we ever had... We must have had guests. The brigadier would have been invited, obviously. And perhaps we might have had some sort of local dignitary of some sort, if they existed out there.
Did you have any connections with the local population?
Well, not a lot, only so far as they act as servants, or else they came into the barracks to do work. In when we went, when we had time off and went into the either Kowloon or across the river to Hong Kong, across the water to Hong Kong in the old Star Ferry there for an evening out for a meal, then you meet the Chinese in the restaurants and things like that. On the beach, we used to sometimes go to beaches and over the weekend take the children. There were some very good beaches outside along the New Territories there. There'd be Chinese there as well. But I'm sure at a higher level there was a lot of must have been a whole lot of contact with Chinese, because I mean the Chinese half ran the colony. I mean, we had the governor there who was a chap called Sir Alexander Grantham, was his name, a member. And there was as far as civil service and police and all the other sort of government agencies were concerned, there were British, but there were a lot of Chinese in high places as well, in the civil service and in the police. And of course, most of the big companies there, although there was Jardine and all those well-known British companies, there were also a lot of the wealthy Chinese had their own companies, and they were very wealthy indeed. And they had big contacts with the government because they were very important people. So at that level, yes, but at our level, the most we saw was the man who came in to empty the El San. And he used to, I remember, yes, I remember now, on a very hot Sunday afternoon, I think, Anne and myself were lying on our bed with hardly any clothes on. I don't think we had anything on at all, just lying there, sort of having a siesta, or Egyptian PT, as it was called. and the El San man would walk straight through with a sort of what do you call these
yoke,
that's right, where he collect the change the El Sans round and then walk through and out again. He never looked in our direction, he just walked through and out. Never may I come in or knock on the door or anything. God, what's that?
Window opening.
Oh, I sound like somebody falling out. And then, of course, round the fields round us, there were, as I said, there was these Chinese, and there were hacker women, they were called, who wore black, and they had these wide straw hats with little curtains round the side, black curtains round the side, to enable them to keep working in the really hot weather. But otherwise, we had little contact. I remember getting on during the year in November, we had the Remembrance Parade. There's a cenotaph there, like the one in Whitehall, in a big square off the main road, with a grassy area all around it, and then it's paved right round the perimeter and all the square. And we got orders to produce the largest contingent there with the band and drums. And as I was adjutant of the battalion that time, I was designated adjutant of the whole parade. So it was like being back in Jamaica again. The CRE, I remember, was the commander of the parade, full colonel. Most of the other regiments produced, I think it was three officers and 60 other ranks. I don't think the other battalions weren't there. We represented the infantry. We were the main. Then there was the gunners, the RE, the RASC, REME, signals, and everybody else. They produced three officers and 60, I think. The RACs and the Navy were there. They had to produce a number as well. And we formed up, I remember. We had to. I don't know, a lot of rehearsing and... And then we had reconnaissances beforehand to do what to know what to do. We formed up on the dockside there somewhere and marched about a mile down the road with our band and drums in front, and formed up round this square. And then the governor appeared like as the Queen did, just before 11 o'clock. There was 2 minutes silence, and then we, our drummers blew, mass bugles blew the last post and rouse, usual sort of service. But that took up quite a bit of time, actually, because I had to keep on going to Hong Kong to do it.
And doing that, the staff work for that?
Yes, I had to do all the staff work, issue all the instructions and everything. And that meant liaising with... That's not a nice word. Don't like liaising. I had to contact the Navy and all the other units and get them organised. And then, of course, it meant going into Hong Kong, which meant driving all the way into Hong Kong, getting the old Star Ferry across, and then going some of the other side. So that, very time-consuming, actually.
Where was your brigade headquarters?
I don't know. I can't remember. It was in the region of Van Ling. It was there quite close by. The other thing we had to do that winter, I remember, was qualifying on the range. And it was the usual firing at... 300 and 500. There was the application, 5 rounds in your own time. Snap, where these little things, round black and white discs, would appear on poles for 5 seconds and then disappear again. You had five, that happened 5 times. And then there was rapid fire, where you had to get 10 rounds off in 60 seconds. So we had to provide butt parties for that, and we had to qualify for that once a year. So you are the marksman, first class or second class. And the only reason why I mention this, because it gives me the opportunity to say I was a marksman, which was probably the highlight of my life.
Was there a great emphasis on shooting in the battalion? Was it taken?
Oh, yes. I was lucky, actually, because I started shooting when I was in my prep school.
Yes.
On the 2-2 range there. I was only 8. And I got a taste for it then, so luckily I was able to shoot with a rifle.
You were able to keep it up all through.
Yeah. So you... I don't know, there's no other officers were marksmen. Mm. There were very few. But there was one chap there who kept on missing, the one left subaltern, who had difficulty hitting the target at all. And of course, when you miss the target, a flag on a pole, a red and white flag, would come up and would then be waved either side of the target where they thought the bullet might have gone. And it was, to me, it was quite often waved too victoriously down the other end, triumphantly waved backwards and forwards, yes. Rub it in. But he became known as the flag lieutenant after a bit. Because he had the greatest difficulty in hitting the target. I was no good with an LMG. I could shoot with it, but I don't think I qualified very high with them.
But with the rifle you marked them?
Yeah. One of the proudest moments of my life. That and having a public vehicle... driving license. I can drive a bus.
Always a useful skill.
Very useful, yes. We did take a, when we had some leave, we went to Macau, down the coast, 50 miles, Portuguese territory. I remember we left young Timothy with the Miseroys across the road, and they very kindly looked after him for a long weekend, I think we took. There was a ferry which used to run from Hong Kong down to Macau, and we took that. But of course, Macau is entirely different. The Japanese hadn't occupied it, and therefore there were trees there, which you know, you notice these things when you go there. Mm. And we stayed in a hotel or a boarding house or something, which was on the front there. And all the way down the front, there were these... trees, and they were all in bloom with flowers, and it was quite beautiful. We took a trip round in a trishaw there with a bicycle with a like a
Like a rickshaw,
but with a bicycle.